is the Paul McGuire Report. I'm Paul McGuire. Today, as never before, you and I stand at the very doorway into the future. Imagine for a moment that you and I are standing, because we really are standing before two different doorways. You and I are standing, and many other people, countless numbers of other people, are also standing before a doorway, or let's put it this way, two different doorways into the future. And depending upon which doorway we choose to walk through, and each doorway represents the entry path into an entirely different future, our future, the lives, our lives, the lives of our children, the lives of our grandchildren, the lives of people we know, people we don't know, little children and orphans and people in need all over planet Earth, all over the United States. And so much, I mean, a lot. I've said this so often that I know I have probably transgressed the law of repetition and have repeated it. But I am compelled to repeat it. And I'm still saying it, except I'm saying it at this present moment in a slightly softer tone. Why? Because the weight, the enormity of what grips my mind, my heart, and soul, a weight, a burden from the Holy Spirit, has been placed on me for decades and decades. And the vast majority of those decades were God's preparation decades. And so I had to just proceed forward by faith because I really didn't have a clear, airtight plan for like where I was going. I had a general plan. I had a plan. I had a vision. But it wasn't airtight. It wasn't crystal clear. It wasn't, as they say in the feature film business, it wasn't in critical focus. And those of you that are photographers know that critical focus is when you're using a camera, any kind of camera that employs a lens. And you can capture an actor or an actress or a nature scene or whatever, and it can be almost perfectly in focus. But if you're off just a microscopic amount, then you will lose what's called critical focus, and there will be a slight blur to everything, which you may want, if you want to, let's say, for lack of better words, romanticize the photo. I mean, there have been plenty of famous movie stars and movie star actresses who deliberately, whenever they got a publicity shot, this is going back into the 1930s in the film business up to the present moment, they would deliberately make sure that the camera had a very subtle out of focus setting. So there would be a very, very almost unnoticeable blur over their faces that the average person really wouldn't notice. But it would get rid of their wrinkles. It would get rid of the lines in their faces. It would get rid of any fatigued look. So in the old days, in Hollywood publicity, up until the present time, blurring the face of a star or whatever is a technique that's still used to make somebody look more youthful and more attractive and hide, most of all, to hide any faults they may have. Because this goes back into the decades long before plastic surgery was even thought of, and long before, you know, all this stuff that people can get shot up with, Botox and many other injections that can make the face look younger. I forgot how Botox works. I think it has something to do with, it's some kind of, don't quote me if I'm wrong, or you can send me an email and give me an education. I'm probably off on this. But I believe Botox, the injection is somehow poisonous or something like that. It's probably a bad adjective. To muscles in the face or other parts of the body, but specifically the face. So when you inject an actor or an actress or whoever wants a Botox injection, it causes the nerve ending to stop working fully, which then allows the nerve endings to just let the muscles completely loose. There's no constriction of the muscles. So the muscles just like externally almost like collapse. Now that sounds like weird, but what happens is that allows the wrinkles to be smoothed out. It can make you 10, 20, or 30 years younger. But as you know, what's dicey, maybe you don't know, you know, I do want to come up with her about Botox, and there's other stuff. I can't remember the name, but Botox is the most famous. But when you were in the Hollywood film industry, as I was for many years, and when you were an independent feature film producer and you cast actors and actresses, et cetera, and you spend a lot of time in that culture, now the whole nation, in just about every major city or any sizable town, has to be a sizable town, I suppose, there is now some kind of local, they go by all kinds of different names, spa treatment, but then they'll offer Botox injections, etc. And the idea is it makes the face look a lot younger. It also fills in crevices. It fills in the wrinkles. It gets rid of wrinkles. A lot can be done. However, as you know, and I know, there's a big gamble when you use that regularly, and depending upon who you hire, their level of expertise and training, by God's grace, and I'm going to be careful here because I don't like to use corporate names or the names of famous people indiscriminately, but being that we originally came to Hollywood to, my wife was an, Christina was an actress, Christian actress, and I was a producer, executive producer of science fiction feature films. And Chris starred in a few films, and she has a small but notable scene in Tom Selleck's Western movie, The Shadow Writers. Other TV shows and films. So in any case, we made a lot of friends, or we made we made a lot of friends over the years that she was working and trying to get work as an actress, and over the years I was producing feature films and promoting feature films and writing feature films and all that stuff. You just develop working relationships, friendships, and contacts within the industry. Now, what I'm about to say, I'm gonna censor a lot of what I'm about to say because I don't want to be misconstrued as bragging, and I certainly don't want to drop names of people who are famous and destroy the potential privacy of the conversation. But we have so. A significant degree, I don't know what a significant degree is, but a percentage of our friends became very, very famous in the industry, household names, and very, very wealthy, because the film and entertainment business gives you that opportunity if you make it. So one of our mutual friends was not only an actress at the time. That's how we got to know her. But this particular individual, I'll just put it this way, she became so proficient. She became such an expert on you know, like Botox and face and stuff like that, that she, her clientele is like exclusively the big time, big shot movie stars, actors, actresses. I mean, the best of the best of the best, because she has a reputation for making people look younger without destroying their faces. And I'll give you an example. My wife and I have been, when we're not busy doing stuff for the ministry or whatever, we're deliberately trying to watch, to be more selective in watching films. We've really stopped watching a lot of the news. Now, certain news channels I will watch because I need, because of what I do, I need to be on top of what's really happening. But the vast majority of the mainstream media is not only worse than a swamp, it's like a radioactive gangrene barf pit from hell. I mean, it really is. It is immoral. It's filled with lies. I mean, it's the things that they say. I mean, talking heads actually calling for the death of a president and then go and pretending they're a journalist on a network. It's an atrocity. So you know, my suggestion is don't watch those networks anymore. They're already dying on the vine. But even one network is kind of waffling. You better put the pressure on them, or by the time you blink, they will become a liberal network. So the point is that, also the people, the stars, the big stars in the news business, the overwhelming majority in the news business, if you can call it that, the fake news business, are heavy consumers of Botox and having their face work done. Now, before you are tempted to judge any of these people, and I don't know that you necessarily would, you have to understand that that is now required. It's not required in every business. The vast majority of businesses, it's not required in. But when you're in the media business, like, you know, mainstream media, looks is everything. Content is not even important. So these girls that get up there are constantly on diets. They're constantly get injected and stuff. And then you have women who are in a different age category, and I'll just name her because it's kind of obvious. Judge Jeanine, who's on Fox. I mean, I think it's fairly obvious that she regularly gets treatments and Botox. And I'm not putting her down for that. You see, you can't judge somebody unless you've lived in their shoes. This is not purely a vanity thing. I don't know how old Judge Jeanine is, but I do know this, that she is competing with women that are 10, 20, 30, and maybe even longer than that, 30 years younger than her, or maybe more. She has to compete with them. And the cold, truthful, brutal reality about the entertainment business and about the mainstream news business is, especially for women and also, though, to a significant degree, men, is you better look young. You better not have wrinkles. You better look really young, even though you may not be that young. Because no matter what they tell you to your face, especially women, they will fire you. Now, they'll never fire you because you're looking older, okay? They'll find, because that would cause lawsuits and discrimination. They'll fire you for some other reason. So Judge Jeanine has to be competitive. And let's just take Fox as an example. There's a lot of people at Fox. Some have different political positions. But I can bet you that the overwhelming majority, if not 100% of the females in Fox and a significant percentage of the males, when I say significant percentage, am I talking 25, 30% of the males? I don't know. I don't know what the exact number is. But they're regularly
getting Botox, and in severe cases, they're getting plastic surgery and stuff. But you better get somebody who's also an artist, a sculptor, highly trained, knows the chemical reaction times backwards and forwards, knows things about anatomy, like how the face balances out. So this person that we knew from 30 years ago when we first came to Hollywood is now a superstar, literally a superstar, businesswoman, model, and inventor of an entire line of material and stuff that can make you look younger. And what's interesting about it, and she would never violate the private stories to us of all the movie stars that she makes house calls to, because she's constantly making house calls. Now, technology has changed radically in the last, 7 years, 8 years, 9 years. And everybody and television and video and communications and mainstream media and models or whatever were all radically thrown a curveball and radically effective when they began to come out with the latest and the greatest high resolution, super high resolution, HD, high definition television sets, cell cameras. Now 5G is on board. And I'm looking in the studio here, and I have equipment that I forgot. I try not to pay attention to the technical side all that much. It drives me crazy. But I have the highest, not every monitor, but the larger monitors in the studio are the highest resolution. And the highest resolution just came out 2 years ago. And the resolution before that was very high. The problem is, when you photograph somebody with these high-resolution cameras and you're using professional lighting, every flaw in their face, their skin, their hair, everything is, it's like looking at people's flaws under a microscope. And so that's a curveball, because a lot of ladies and a certain percentage of men, their careers, they have to look, it's not vanity, because there'll be some young girl or some young guy that'll take their place in a heartbeat. They have to make sure that their faces, however they do it, makeup, facial massages, diet, nutrition, exercise, usually the people use a whole spectrum of factors. They have to look super, super, super young, including getting these Botox treatments and sometimes surgery, because when those powerful high-definition cameras hit you, and people are watching now on their HD and even higher resolution cell phones, laptops, big screens, they see every imperfection on your face, okay? It's like lit up with lights. Now, the old days of hiding are gone. And then people have to make choices. A lot of people who are doing this specialized work are awful. So you could probably name, I could name, because we've been on a quest, my wife and I are so sick of ultra-violent, sexually suggestive programs. I mean, it's just like, I can't take it anymore. You can't even have any film without artificially inserting a certain amount of, you know what I'm talking about, totally unnecessary sex and violence. I'm not talking about porn or stuff like that. I'm just talking about, it's just unnecessary. It's shoved in your face. So we're sick of it. So we've been going back to the older movies or the older television shows in search of a break from the negativity, from the fear, from the super violence, from the blood, from the decapitation, from the sexual immorality in not only the script, but the behavior. You know, you can only eat so much garbage, okay? And what we noticed is we landed on a couple of films by famous actresses, and you probably know their names, like Meg Ryan, okay? Years ago, Meg Ryan had a huge hit with, was it Tom Hanks? I think it was with Tom Hanks. I think it was called Sleepless in Seattle. In any case, what made, is it Megan Fox? I think it's Megan something. Okay, what made her a superstar is she had this, what in Hollywood they call this perfect girl, the perfect pretty girl next door look. It's a very unique look that sounds like it would be easy to find, but it's very difficult to find. Because finding the archetypical girl next door, you see, they want all the guys to fall in love with her, who watch her in movie theaters, and they want all the girls next door to identify with her. So this pretty girl next door thing sounds simple, but it's very hard because it's an idealized, unrealistic image. They want a pretty girl. They want a cute girl. They want an attractive girl, but they don't want her like a supermodel. Okay, now, don't be offended by what I say. I think it would be unnatural and buying into political correctness if a normal male making a normal commentary that would not offend his wife, and this would not offend my wife. That's the major rule. I would imagine, and I don't know, but that Melania Trump has had some work done on her face or Botox or whatever. I don't know that for a fact. But in the culture of supermodels and the big-time models, that's like taking an aspirin, okay? But whoever did work on her, if indeed she even has had work, because she has a very unusual bone structure in her face where if you observe her face like a sculptor or somebody into anatomy, because of her high cheekbones and her ethnic background or whatever, and this is not racism, the skeletal structure of her face seems to naturally and attractively stretch out her skin and kind of organically and naturally get rid of wrinkles that other women would have. It's just a genetic characteristic. Now, I'm not saying she doesn't use Botox in addition. I don't know. But Melania Trump is probably one of the classiest, most beautiful, well, without question, in my opinion, Melania Trump is the classiest, most beautiful, most attractive first lady that we have ever had in the White House by far. And if it wasn't for the poisonous, serpent-like, pathological hatred and demonic hostility that the mainstream media has towards Trump and Melania Trump, she would be, because of her extraordinary beauty and poise, she would be on the cover of Newsweek, Time, and other big publications like every single week. Okay, if they were being fair. But she is totally censored from the media publications, even though she's stunning and classy, because they hate her husband with the pathological hatred. In addition to that, Melania Trump, if you notice her, the way she projects her femininity, I don't know what her relationship with the Lord is like. I'm not going to presume, but I can kind of presume by the physical evidence and the way she, what her countenance suggests, what her eyes radiate, and what she projects. And when you see Melania, you see one of the world's most beautiful women. I mean, we're talking supermodel status, the type of woman that walks through the room and there's 200 guys there and 200 females, and every male head and every female head is turning in the direction of Melania Trump because she's so unusually supermodel attractive. But the thing that makes her unique is, unlike some women who have that same level of physical attractiveness, Melania Trump doesn't seem to carry or project this kind of lustful vibe, this super sexual vibe. Melania Trump doesn't appear to be trading on her genetic sexuality. It's obvious that she is physically attractive, okay? But some women who are physically attractive, they use it as a playing card. Every time they dress, it's tight clothing. They build their whole lives around packaging themselves with a kind of a hypersexuality, right? That's their choice. It's not my business to stick my nose in what somebody else wants to do. But the Bible has something to say about that. The Bible talks about, and by inference it would go to men too, but it began by talking about women. The Bible talks about that one of the characteristics of a godly man or a Christian marriage or a Christian woman or a godly woman, one of the characteristics of a godly woman is that even though she may be very physically attractive, she carries herself and conducts herself with a degree of purity, a degree of modesty, a degree of humility, and with a degree of humbleness, which Melania Trump does. A lot of women, not all, I'm not making some blanket statement, a lot of women, not all, but we all know, come on, we're not stupid, a lot of women who are genetically attractive or whatever, they hype up their attractiveness and sexuality by wearing tight-fitting clothing, by wearing revealing clothing, by wearing seductive clothing or seductive makeup, carrying themselves and walking in a seductive fashion, et cetera, et cetera. We all know what this is about. She doesn't do that. That makes her exceptional. That means she has character, okay? She has character, and that makes her unusual. And it also, you can say or not say that she's the ideal Christian woman. I don't even know if she is a Christian, a born-again Christian. If you wanted to know what I personally suspect that she is a born-again Christian. No matter what her spiritual roots may have been, I would be shocked to find out that she did not pray a prayer somewhere inviting Christ into her life. Why? Because when you look into Melania Trump's eyes, you see a sparkle of life. That the only time I see that sparkle of life coming out of people's eyes is when I'm looking into the eyes of a man or a woman who's a born-again Christian, where the Spirit of Jesus Christ, the Holy Spirit, lives inside them. And so whether they're aware of it or not, they are projecting, they are emanating the presence of the Lord. And when you see the sparkle in their eyes, you recognize it as something familiar. You're looking at the sparkle of Jesus Christ coming out of her eyes. I see that in her eyes. Okay, now, this girl who handles the superstars, because this is such a dicey business with the makeup, especially when you're in high stakes modeling and females in political careers. Well, let's not be naive. There are a lot of women running for high political offices all over the United States. Some are Democrats, some are Republicans, some are running for president or lesser offices. And part or parcel now in the business of big-time politics, female politicians on both sides use different forms of cosmetic surgery. They use Botox, et cetera, to they're not trying to look like 20-year-olds. They have to, whether you like it or not, they can't get elected unless they are able to look
they don't have to look like teenagers, but they have to look somewhat youngish. That's an ambiguous term, I know. And the same with men. The reality is, and Christians need to wake up to this. I guess I was forced to deal with it because I was in the film business. My wife was an actress, so you know, you encounter those things 30 years before they hit the public. And what I noticed is that I would meet all these actresses, and they all, I mean, I knew roughly how old they were, but they all looked 20 years younger, and they all had their, quote, defects worked on. Now, you can say, well, that's vanity, blah, 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 and again, that's fine. But remember that in this real world that we live in, it's image over substance. Content is secondary, and people judge a book by its cover in this media-oriented business. So, if you want to be elected, you have to put yourself together physically and take advantage of those things. So this person we know who's like one of the best at doing this in the entire world, she gets a private phone call on her cell phone. And I can't name the names of the people. She's very close-lipped about who her clients are. But they're the biggest stars in Hollywood. And she'll go to their mansions because they can't go outside, especially before they have a shoot or whatever. So then you take somebody like Meg Ryan. That's who I meant to get her name right. Meg Ryan had this perfect girl-next-door look, cute, pretty attractive, but she wasn't vampy or sluttish. You know what I'm talking about? I'm just being real. So like just roll with me, okay? So Meg Ryan had this perfect girl next door look, and that's why she was big at the box office. I don't know what happened. She went to the wrong plastic surgeon, or she had the wrong Botox work done on her face. And whatever amateur did the Botox and the plastic surgery on her face ruined her face so badly that she completely lost her trading card. She completely lost her pretty girl next door look. She completely lost her, innocent, I'm pretty, I'm the girl next door. That whole thing that was written in every portion of her face. That's why they did not cast Meg Ryan because she was the most beautiful actress. They cast Meg Ryan because she was the pretty girl next door image. So she goes to a plastic surgeon, a Botox person. They ruin her face, and she has spent, I've heard, allegedly a fortune trying to get her face re-put together to look, you know, close to what it used to be, because she has not been able to work, get enough jobs, appear in enough starring roles ever since she had this bad facelift and this bad Botox. She's kind of pretty, but dark and lost the girl next door part. So we happened to see a movie with her after her facelift and Botox, and she was attractive, but this was a dark movie. It was a murder mystery, a dark movie, and we turned it off because the movie was unacceptable for us. I mean, there's, you know, we have standards. There's certain things we're not going to watch. But she had a pretty look, okay? She was attractive. She had many of the qualities that would make a woman a star in Hollywood. But the most important quality of all, which is her unique signature look, which is the pretty girl next door look, she completely lost. And so she stopped working. And she did a couple of films, and the Botox wasn't right. And because she was unable to capture the pretty girl next door look, her career was just bam. From Sleepless in Seattle, and I forgot what else she did, she's never been able to recover it. And tragically, there's a lot of women like that, and even some men. Now, in the movie Jerry Maguire, starring Tom Cruise, I always get asked about the movie Jerry Maguire, obviously, because I'm Paul Maguire. So everybody comes up to me at conferences that I speak at, or if they meet me in the street or whatever, and go, they'll make some wise guy, wise girl comment about, it's Jerry Maguire, and they'll shout it. And you know, I laugh because it's funny to me. I mean, after all the years of being called Jerry Maguire, and then the punchline to the joke they give me is, show me the money. So when I say, show me the money or whatever, they're happy. So I get a kick out of it. I think it's funny. Jerry Maguire stars Tom Cruise, but his female co-star was one of the hottest actresses in Hollywood. I mean, this girl was just rocking and rolling. She was headed to be one of the biggest stars in Hollywood because she can act too. And that is Renee Zellweger. So Renee Zellweger, like Meg Ryan, had one of these very, very unique, perfect, pretty girl next door looks. The way she carried herself, the way she talked, her persona. And then she makes the same stupid mistake after Meg Ryan. And the guy ruins her face. I'm not saying she's ugly. I'm not saying she's unattractive. But like Meg Ryan, she lost her moneymaker. And don't read into that any more than should be. And if you're reading more into it than what it should be, it's your problem, not mine. Okay? When I'm saying her moneymaker, need to get out of bar of soap for your mind. When I say her moneymaker, I'm talking about her cute girl next door looks and mannerisms. She got Botox, plastic surgery, totally lost it all, and she looked like she's improved it, but she's looked weird. So she is now back in the game, but with a big minus, because she's determined to go ahead and reprove herself again as a serious actress without the pretty girl next door look. Okay, because even in Jerry Maguire, she still had that pretty girl next door look. Okay, that's the whole reason Jerry Maguire clicked and the magic happened with Tom Cruise. There were many attractive actresses in the Jerry Maguire movie. There's a 1 second. There's this like a scene that's 30 to 45 seconds in the movie that is totally objectionable in Jerry Maguire. If you see it, you need to either preview it and speed through it or not see it at all. It is not appropriate for children. I don't think it's appropriate for adults either. It is a very graphic scene and totally unnecessary, by the way. And it's played by Kelly Preston, who was the wife of, what's his name? I guess I was revisiting his movies. What's his name? John Travolta. And she's a very attractive actress, et cetera, et cetera. But she doesn't have the girl next door look. Kelly Preston's an attractive actress. She's pretty. She's physically attractive. But she doesn't, there's a million girls like that in Hollywood. She lacks the girl next door element. And now, tragically, she's dead. I believe she died of breast cancer. So the point is that the Hollywood girl next door has been a staple. And so since everybody's face is like a piece of art, and some people genetically, it's easier for some people because of their DNA, their genetics, yes, their race, and don't, you know, if you get hung up about me talking about truth, then, you know, I don't know, detox your brain, okay? Because I can't have an intelligent, coherent conversation if I have to politically edit out definitions and characteristics of reality, definitions and characteristics of people, races, and ethnic groups, which are not intended to imply anybody's inferior or to put anybody down, but to simply comment on what a lot of people would consider a positive attribute that certain races possess. So it shouldn't be misconstrued as some kind of racism, because I'm not a racist. So put that in your frying pan and fry it for a while. I'm not a racist. I've never been a racist. And I will not tolerate ever somebody calling me a racist. And the times that people have debated me on Fox, I remember debating in one of my earlier debates, I debated an African-American host of a national public radio show. And I was the super conservative on Fox, and she was the super liberal, and they wanted us to debate. And, I study the game before I go into the ring. And I knew she was going to pull the race card. Okay? I knew she was. And this isn't a racist statement, but this particular reporter and journalist, who happened to be African-American, that's not the central point. She could have been white, but she didn't know her stuff. I knew her stuff better than she knew her stuff. And by stuff, I'm talking about her personal knowledge of the civil rights movement, the movement, Black history, versus my personal knowledge of the civil rights movement and Black history. Yes, it's true. I can't possibly know what it's like to live as a Black American or African American in America. I can't possibly tell you I know what it's like to be discriminated against and treated in an inferior or disparaging manner simply because of my race. And yes, I do enjoy unique protections because I am white, right? That's full transparency. And it happens to be true. Now, am I saying that's good? No, I'm saying that's a bad thing. It needs to be dealt with, all right? But it's not dealt with by burning down cities and shooting policemen in the head, nor is it dealt with by creating a super hot chamber climate where the cops have no sleep, they're armed, they're like half crazed from no sleep, et cetera, et cetera, and they're baited into violence. I'm not whitewashing, no pun intended, the places where there's been criminality found on the side of the police. But there's also been criminality found on the side of the demonstrators. So this girl next door look, so I had to debate this Black activist female. I would say she was attractive. She was personable. She appeared knowledgeable, but she didn't really do her homework. So for example, I don't go on to Fox or anybody. I don't play somebody else's game. The first thing I did was I interrupted her because I noticed by watching videotapes of her earlier debates that her main strategy, especially with white talk show hosts, was to dominate the conversation with endless blah, 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 blah. So her opponent can't get a word in edgewise. So she wins the argument, not because she knows anything, but because she dominates it verbally and doesn't give you a chance to respond or answer a question while she impugns your character and goes for the jugular. Okay, so the Fox team is there and everybody else. They're watching in New York, their producers, all the anchorwoman, the anchorman, big, big execs on Fox are watching. And I'm debating her. And so one screen is me, Paul McGuire, radio talk show host, Los Angeles, California, and I forgot her name. So she starts to do her thing, which I knew what she was going to do because I studied the videotape. See, I do my homework. And I knew she was going to attempt to nonstop filibuster, nonstop talk, throw out lies, and then talk over me so I couldn't say anything. So what I did is she was going on, and she literally sounded like phonetically. This isn't a racial thing, because she was talking so fast. She was going like blah 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 blah. That's what it sounded like. Okay, she was just filling the noise, the space with noise. So I interrupted her, and I said, you know, just because you blah 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 and blah 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 blah, and I annoyingly did it for like a minute, I said, doesn't mean you have a clue that you know what you're talking about. All you're doing is going blah 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 to keep me from talking. I said, the fact of the matter is, when I was 14 years old, to show you I was not a racist and to prove my solidarity with the African American community, at 14 years old, I got on the bus from Jackson Heights, Queens, took the bus to Corona, California, where I went to the Black Panther Party headquarters for all of New York City. And I went down to the storefront where they had their offices for the Black Panther Party. And I asked if I could become an official, as a white guy, could I become an official member of the Black Panther Party? Could I join the Black Panther Party? And remember, I was walking among gang members and thugs, and everybody was wearing black leather jackets. And if I had any sense in my brain at the time, which believe me, I did, I would never have done something, because I was about ready to be jumped by the local gang when they saw this white guy come out of the bus on Northern Boulevard. But fortunately, just up ahead, it wasn't that many feet. I knew that if I could walk quickly, I could get myself to the entranceway into the Black Panther Party headquarters. So as the gang members saw me headed into the Black Panther Party headquarters, they backed off, and they wanted to see what was going to happen. Because, see, the Black Panther Party was like it. They were the man. I mean, they were in charge. They were like the toughest, and they had the raw respect of the gangs. And once the gangs could see that I was being accepted by the Black Panther Party leaders and talking to them, the gangs backed off me in reverential respect. Now, she tried to interrupt again and saying I was making this up. And then I said, you know, the problem with having to answer with a lie is you don't know what you're talking about. And then I drilled her on high-level members of the Black Panther Party who were the heads of the Black Panther Party at that time period in history. I had read their books. I knew them in person. She didn't even know who they were. So I finally said, you're accusing me of making this up, yet I know the name, the title, the date, and the place of all the leading Black Panther Party members in the 70s. And these were famous people, people like Huey Newton and others. I said, you don't have a clue who these people are. I said, I know more about the Black Panther Party and the civil rights movement that grew out of the Black Panther Party than you did. And then when I did the blah, 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 blah joke, the mics were left on accidentally in Fox News, and a whole bunch of the staff was roaring in laughter. Roaring in laughter, not because they were racist, because I was simply telling the truth. I didn't play the politically correct game. So what's my point here? My point is, we're in a media culture. You gotta get it right. And if you're filming someone's face or recording the audio or you're making a verbal communication or whatever it is, you have to be effective. Misfires don't count. And so whether you're having your face adjusted, as many ladies choose to do and some men choose to do, whether you're choosing a suit or whatever, you have to communicate in the most effective, strategic way possible. And your target audience is not just to win the people you know already agree with you. If you're to be effective and successful, you have to fully engage the target audience that is basically alienated or have rejected what they think your message is, which is rah-rah conservatism and, you know, recite the American flag, which is, that's not what I'm all about. I'm a lot deeper than that. So words are your weapons. Images are your weapons. Sound bites are your weapons. You got to dress right, look right, et cetera, et cetera. And if you don't, you've lost the battle of communications before it has begun. Now, I wish I could give a lecture on this at major Christian universities across the nation. I would do it. I turned down a lot of requests. I would do it because there are endless thousands of Christian aspiring leaders in all fields who have never been taught how to effectively communicate, strategically communicate. They've never been taught how to win the argument without coming off like a jerk. They've never been taught how to combat fearlessly political correctness. They've never been taught about how much power you can tap into on a psychological level and on a debate level when you bother to do your homework, when you bother to study your subject. The person you're debating against is going to fall apart and look like a buffoon. Our goal is not to embarrass people, but our goal is to defeat dramatically and, yes, spectacularly. Our goal is to defeat spectacularly the lies of the enemy, to defeat once and for all. You know, give me a paragraph on Fox or some other big media outlet, and I can take down in a 15-minute conversation, if I can speak that long, I can take down any seduction that communism, Marxism, socialism, and the rest of that garbage has. Why? Why am I effective? Because I've studied. I've trained myself. And that's what you've got to do in any arena of life, whether you're going for a job, whether you're going for a career or whatever it is. You've got to study. You've got to acquire knowledge, which is power. You've got to read. You've got to watch videos. Here's another case in point. And you say, well, why are you saying this? Because this is obvious to me and you. I can't tell you how many few secular politicians bother to do this and come off looking like buffoons. But Christian spokespeople, men and women, when you're coming off like a buffoon, you're not winning the argument. People are dismissing you. Here's another example. By the way, of all the debates that I had on Fox News Network and CNN, which were a lot of debates over 10 years, I can say that I did not lose a single debate and that I won every single debate that I participated in for 10 years. There were some close calls, but I always won. And this is why I won. Because in my first debate, you know, I knew that I was a gifted debater. So we all have pride. Paul McGuire has to deal with it too. And I began to rest on my pride and rest on the fact that I knew that I was an incredible debater. I knew that I never lost a debate, and I knew that I could pulverize just about anybody, plus make people laugh as an effective tool in winning the debate. So subconsciously, I was resting on my flesh, my carnal man. To be blunt, I was resting on my pride of previous accomplishments, forgetting the very subtle spiritual lesson that, you know, pride can be very subtle. The next thing you know, you're snared by it. And so I just assumed I was going to debate this big-time, super-liberal radio talk show host from San Francisco, okay? And so what happened was I had a couple of debates with him. But my first debate, it was hard. I mean, we battled. I'd take a punch, he'd take a punch. I'd take a punch, he'd take a punch. And we were both delivering some knockout blows. But I can't say that either of us lost or either of us won. I might have barely won, but barely. I certainly didn't win. Now, I said to myself, whoa, I realized when I was talking to my wife, I was unprepared. I underestimated my enemy. because of my pride. Big mistake. So I got on the internet and I watched about 8 or 9 of his debates, his earlier debates on Fox or CNN. And I studied his techniques, like, you know, like prize fighters used to do with 8mm film and stuff. And so I realized the very same techniques he was using to dominate the debate, the techniques he was using to control me, the techniques he was using to marginalize me and maximize himself, that in our debate on Fox just a couple of weeks earlier, he had done all those same maneuvers, point by point. He just went through his playbook and did it. Problem is, I didn't study it, and so every time he would launch out on an attempt to take me down, I would have to figure out on the spot what to do, which is a lot more work than watching him and studying him and know what he's going to do by his previous performance. So, thank God, I learned from my mistake. And I learned he had about 5 or 6 knockout blow verbal rebuttals that he would work in. And he wasn't all that imaginative because he kept using them. Okay, so instead of debating with him before, you know, millions of people and losing, I now debated him, but now it was like I was hammering him hard. He was on the defensive from the first sentence since he got out. He was on the total defensive. I had him boxed in, and I was pulverizing him with questions, facts that I had memorized, documentation. And he wasn't used to it, because at this time, it was early in the game. Paul McGuire really, this was now Paul McGuire's only second live nationwide debate on Fox News. It was only my second one, okay? So I was the new boy in the block, and I had to prove myself. So I hammered him in the debate, and because I humiliated him, not because I was being punitive, not because I was being mean, but because of his big ego, I was humiliating him because I kept bringing up things that he could not answer, because I knew what was going to drive him to the breaking point, and I knew that his ego and temper would be his own demise. And look, let's get real. We have many of the same faults that we criticize others for. So what happens is I'm winning the debate, I'm pounding on him, and the next thing you know, he thinks he's just going to totally give me a knockout verbal response. It's a cute little joke. Had something to do about denial, because I accused him of living in denial, and he made some joke about the Nile, you know, river in Egypt or something, but his joke didn't work. So what happened was I got in my remark. He was humiliated because he couldn't answer it, which means he looked like a doofus. And then he didn't realize it, but Fox did not take the cameras off him. In the transition, Fox News Network left the cameras and the microphone on and faced right at him. And he didn't realize that he then lost his temper on national TV, on Fox, as in a huge fit of fury. He's pounding his hands on the desk table. He takes the headphones and he dramatically rips the headphones off his head. And he throws the headphones and the wire down on the ground by his seat as hard as he can, and then starts cursing and stuff and completely losing it. Now, so for the person on television, this display of losing it, you know, it was just like, I don't know, it's under 20 seconds. But it doesn't look good for you to have a meltdown, lose your temper, throw your headphones down, because what you're communicating to the mass audience is, hey, I'm mad because I just lost the debate. The reason I'm throwing my headphones down and losing my temper and cursing at me is because I know I lost the debate. Instead of acting cool and just saying, let bygones be bygones, he has a meltdown. And the meltdown is basically him signing off on the fact that he miserably lost the debate. And then he does these hysterics on camera. So the point I'm making is from that point forward, I essentially studied the techniques of all my debating opponents, and over a 10-year period, I never lost any debate. The closest I came to losing a debate was artificial, and that was when CNN had me on to debate a hot topic subject, which was gay marriage. I didn't compromise, but I didn't fit into all the predictable, judgmental traps that so many Christians, I didn't betray the truth at all, but I didn't fall into the trap of making all the predictable, legalistic, self-righteous statements. I used humor and sarcasm, and I won over the gay activists I were just debating with. And I had the CNN audience stand up and give me a standing ovation. Why? Because I didn't come off like Mr. Moral Superman. I didn't come off as, I came off as human, okay? This was CNN. But CNN did another show with me where they weren't so honest, and the makeup girl painted my face a deep, bright orange, the color of a Halloween pumpkin. She did it on purpose because she knew my position and she wanted to visually sabotage me. And I didn't realize how bad it looked until I got on set and I looked in the monitor and I could see myself sitting in a chair and I have a pumpkin colored face. And then when I was debating with the people in LA, and then I was debating with the host in Atlanta, Georgia, where CNN's headquarters were, because the host kept cutting me off. This is the bottom line. Every time I tried to make a point, every time I tried to score a point, every time I tried to finish a sentence, the host of CNN cut me off to make sure I would superficially lose the argument and discussion. The reason I couldn't win the argument is I could never finish any statement that I began with. So I wearied of that. And I said to myself, you know what? I'm going to at least take one subject, one truth, and I'm not going to play by heart or rules. And what I decided, we're getting into a heated debate on the importance of the nation of Israel to America and the importance of Israel to the rest of the world in terms of global politics, all right? Which is also a Bible prophecy type of topic, so I was very familiar with it. So I was debating with her and then somebody else, and that she threw out an inflammatory attack. The CNN host attacked Israel viciously. So instead of just bowing, which you sometimes have to do, otherwise literally they'll kick you off of the air right then and there. They'll just cut your mic and you'll disappear. I bucked her. Took a calculated risk. I bucked her, and I said, I thundered into the microphone, because the reason I thundered into the microphone is every time I would win a debate at CNN, they would always turn my volume down, so nobody in the studio audience in Atlanta could hear me. So I deliberately thundered into the microphone so my audio would override the fact that they rigged my microphone and turned it down, and so that the studio audience and the studio hosts at CNN would very clearly be able to hear me, even though they had turned down my microphone. So I thundered out something to the effect that The nation of Israel is a nation of eternal purpose, and it's in the United States' best interest to fully support, stand with, and pray the nation of Israel. And man, I walloped that baby out, that sentence out. And obviously, because those that bless Israel will be blessed; those that curse Israel will be cursed. My calculation was not based on just rationalism. I was stepping out, saying what I believe, what God wanted said, and I was expecting by faith that God would supernaturally reward and bless me, because it says, those that bless Israel, I will bless, and those that curse Israel, I will curse. So what happened when we came back from the break, she was livid that I had actually got in the positive remark about Israel. She was like livid. And I knew I had to make a calculated choice. Some of you may not understand this. If I came off arrogant, I would not win with her audience. I wouldn't win with her. Okay? So she wanted her pound of flesh. So even though I didn't do anything wrong, because you've got to remember, the reason I raised my voice is because every time I tried to speak, she cut my microphone. There was a reason why I raised my voice, because every time I tried to talk, she turned down the volume. So she then gets me live on air and says something to the fact that you interrupted me, Mr. McGuire. And she set it up in such a way that she was expecting an apology. And then I had to make one of those all-important nanosecond decisions. I wasn't afraid. I had declined to be on other shows. I don't need CNN. I wasn't afraid. But I didn't want to make a non-strategic decision. See, it's all about not making your emotional decision, not making the decision that you think is right. But in order to win the greatest battle for the hearts and minds of mankind in the history of the world, you have to make the appropriate, effective, and strategic decisions that will ensure you victory in the moment you're using them. I hope you track with me on that. So I decided, in the interest of strategy, not illusory temporal victory, in the interest of long-term strategy, which was to win the war, I needed to, in the short term, give her an apology, because what this apology was really about was her getting her ego and her status back. So I said, I forgot her name, but I said, so-and-so, I apologize for interrupting you during the last discussion. And then she let go of it, you know, because I bowed, she let go of it. And then she gave me, ironically, she backed down a little bit and opened up more space for me to say what I really wanted to say. But it comes down to making those effective decisions. And that means you're prepared, but your iron sharpens our iron. You're trained, okay? If you're walking out on a national debate with millions of people watching and you haven't studied your subject and you haven't studied the program, and you haven't studied the strategies of the hosts and the other guests, guess what? Do God, do the angels in heaven a favor. Do God a favor, do the angels of heaven a favor, and don't show up and make an appearance on a national television show debating conservative or Christian principles when you're not prepared. Because it would do us all a big, big favor if you would choose to forget your ego and just admit, you know what, I'm not ready yet. And after you've studied the techniques, the strategy, the effectiveness, then make your appearance so you can win and not lose and make a fool out of yourself for the kingdom of God. I'm very serious about what I'm saying. Very serious. The key to be effective is to win. Because the battles are more intense. So for right now, okay, Paul McGuire will not return a phone call from CNN. or any of the mainstream media. The only people that I will entertain going on, and it's only some shows, is Fox News Network. Because at least you get a fair shot most of the time. But even some of those shows I wouldn't go on. Of the mainstream media, of like 2, 4, 7, NBC, CBS, ABC, and, you know, MSNBC and CNN, the lying, the distortion, the psychopathic nature of the questioning, the complete irrationality of the environment, I won't go on. I won't go on. Not after being painted like a Halloween pumpkin and having my volume turned down. No, I don't need you. You know, my numbers, the ironic thing is that when I was doing this, my numbers of listeners to the Paul McGuire show were larger numerically just about every day of the week. The Paul McGuire Show, which was a nationally syndicated radio show that played all across the United States, 3 hours to 8 hours a day in major markets all across the USA, that show numerically had more listeners or followers than CNN, MSNBC, and many of the other mainstream media shows. I had more people listening and watching when you added up all those markets because people were hungry for an intelligent conservative voice. Okay, what is this all about? What this is all about is the intensity of the battle is increasing. All right? The agility, the deceit, the manipulation in the commercials, in the images, in the audio, in the video, in the you know, lines they invent, you know, the campaign lines and stuff. It's a media war. And what is a media war? It's a multimedia war. So what is that really? What the presidential election race really is, it's a microcosm of this greatest spiritual battle for the hearts and minds of mankind in the history of the world that's going on right now in the United States, European Union, and around the world. What's happening all around the world, especially with millennials and young people and even young adults. You know, my work, my research as a writer takes me into all kinds of worlds, all kinds of environments, meeting all kinds of people. Many of them are exceptional in their fields. I mean, people who work for NASA and JPL, and I could go on and on and on. And you'd be surprised how many highly intelligent people, highly educated people, may have completely different politics and a completely different philosophy than you have. And you would be surprised how many people I meet, maybe the same is true for you, but I live in California and New York. You would be surprised that so many of these people who are kind of like atheists, agnostics, etc., they came from born-again Christian families in the Midwest. Or half their family is still, you know, really solid born-again Christians. And I asked myself, well, what happened? Okay, what happened? How come they didn't continue to walk? How come they rejected the faith? And then that's one of the main purposes of this ministry. This is something I asked the Lord for 30 years ago. I said, Lord, I'm asking you to use me, Paul McGuire, and to use this ministry, Paul McGuire Ministries in Paradise Mountain Church. I'm asking you to use this ministry to win millions of souls, Jesus Christ, and to capture and regain millions of souls who have backslidden and have turned their backs on Jesus Christ. Lord, let this ministry be effective in its approach, in its communication, in its books, in its content, in its video, in its audio, in its social media, and the way we approach things. Lord, let us be highly effective in reaching those people who hate Christianity and have totally been turned off by Christianity, and let us be effective in winning those people who, because of having a very negative experience with Christianity, have backslidden or rejected or walked away from Christianity. Lord, send me to regather in those people that have turned their backs on you, and help me to win millions of those people who either rejected Christ because they were turned off by it, or they were raised in a Christian environment and what they saw repulsed them and they walked away from it. And you'd be surprised. One of the biggest differences between this ministry, Paul McGuire Ministries and Paradise Mountain Church, and my approach, Paul McGuire, one of the biggest differences is that our emphasis, our priority, is winning those people who are the hardest, most difficult people to reach. And our goal is to reach them effectively with the gospel of Jesus Christ, so they'll turn their lives around, become born again, and follow Christ. Or if they're backslidden, let our message be so effective that they decide to stop backsliding and return to Jesus Christ. To me, the weight of my heartbeat is always on effectiveness. Okay? Now, I'll tell you why the Lord put that in my heart and soul. And he continues to honor that request to this very day. Because when I miraculously accepted Christ, you have to understand that at that time in my life, which is early 20s, I hated the religion of Christianity. I hated it more than any other religion. If you named all the religions and put them in a list, Christianity would have been perhaps on the bottom of the list. Maybe the Hare Krishna Society would have been even lower, but then it would have been Christianity. And you remember the Hare Krishnas are those people who would wear those day glow orange pajamas and dance up and down in airports, banging tambourines, chanting for money. They would have shaved heads and long ponytails, and they would bang their tambourines and sing this Hindu chant. Sorry for the Hindu chant. It would be something like, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Rama Rama, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Rama Rama. And they chanted, you know, like until they got into a trance. And I said to myself, that is the worst religion known to man. Christianity is second. Because basically, to be Hare Krishna, you had to be a full-blown psychotic and lunatic. But everywhere I went, whenever I was looking to see a living, vibrant, realistic, convincing example of what Christianity was supposed to be about, it always came up zero or negative. Every time I looked at a so-called Christian institution, Christian ministry, Christian witness, Christian whatever, whenever I was exposed to something Christian, it was always a deeply negative experience, which reinforced in me a negativity. It reinforced into me a intellectual rejection of Christianity as not possibly even being remotely true. Why? Because every Christian I debated with didn't know what they were talking about. They knew nothing about history. They had no knowledge about anything. Every Christian I debated with in debate classes, I remember my first year at the University of Missouri, majoring in altered states of consciousness. I attend the debate class. As usual, I'm stoned, you know, when I attend debate class. Most people probably wouldn't have known that I was stoned, except for people who got stoned. But because the way I conducted myself, even though I was high, I conducted myself as a fully engaged, fully intellectually alive, fully sharp, and cognizant individual. I didn't walk around in a stupor. That's what I'm trying to say. So I go to debate class. It's like one of the first debate classes. You know, and I'm going to confess something to you now that I forgot until like 4 months ago. As I was reflecting on this, I had forgotten that once upon a time in Paul McGuire's life, one of Paul McGuire's biggest secret fears and phobias was the terror and the horror of being called upon to make a speech or a talk publicly. The thought of public speaking or making a speech in public gripped me with terror. It made me shake. It was my biggest fear. Now, I forgot that, and then I forgot the statistics that I had read, that I wasn't the only one, that for a huge percentage of male executives, female executives, for a huge percentage of females and males in the business world, they too, their biggest fear is being called upon to make a speech or a public presentation in public. To have to talk in public is their greatest fear. It petrifies them. Now, I forgot that I had the same fear. But you know how we play games with ourselves. I push that fear into my subconscious. So the first time we debate, there's no warning. These two girls are in the classroom, debate class. I'm in the classroom. There's about 30 other people. And these two girls make a presentation about why Christianity is historically true, scientifically true, and why Christianity and the resurrection of Jesus Christ really happened. Okay? So I'm listening. I'm listening fairly intently. These two girls give a presentation. And so they talk for about 10 or 15 minutes, okay? And that was her presentation, and that was supposed to convince us that Christianity was true. So I simply, and I admit to you, I wasn't the nicest, okay? I'm sorry. I kind of cross-examined them, and I probed them and asked them questions about what I perceived to be inconsistencies, unanswered questions, gaps in their theories, stuff that was illogical and irrational. I paid attention to that, and then as a counter-debater, I asked them questions. I pinned them down with the standard questions that people use on you and me today, like, how can you say that God is a loving God and he allows so many horrible and evil things to happen? I mean, you can bet people are going to ask you that question. How come God doesn't allow everybody to go to heaven? You know, I mean, these are hard, but they're simple questions. So after I probed them with these questions in front of the whole class, they were shaking and trembling because they could not answer from an intellectual, rational, logical perspective. They could not sufficiently answer any of my questions or challenges. They didn't even try. After a couple of minutes, they started to break down, and I wasn't trying, I promise you, I wasn't trying to humiliate them, because this wasn't Fox, this was a college classroom. But they started to break down and cry and sob. And they broke down and cried and sobbed because they were so frustrated that they were unable to answer any of my questions, and they feared, correctly so, that they looked like idiots and morons for being totally not properly equipped to answer the questions that would be raised in their debate. And so by simply asking what anybody would ask, they fell apart and started crying. And a lot of people felt sorry for them in the classroom. And, you know, and I didn't feel good that they were crying, but I didn't feel sorry for them either, because nobody warned me. And you know, I wasn't trying to ridicule them. I was just trying to intellectually, forcefully refute their claims in Christ. You understand? I wasn't trying to pick on them. So, God knows how to take care of his own. I don't think I've ever told you this part. So anyway, the professor, he must have been a Christian or something, or the professor may have been setting things up to humble me, which was a good thing. So anyway, my time, I'm given my assignment, it has to do with the debate of Christianity with these girls. And so like 2 weeks from now, I have to deliver now like a 45-minute presentation in front of like three of his classes. He must have done this on purpose. And secretly, I discovered that I am terrified about speaking in public places. I never realized it. The reason I never realized it is I never asked myself the question. And so I'm getting ready. I'm doing all my studying, but privately in the room in the house where I live, I'm shaking, man. I'm not letting any friends see how scared I am. I'm not scared of them. I'm just shaking of fear of public speaking because, you know, the fear of public speaking is connected to the fear of being perceived as an idiot. And I was shaking. And so, like a bigger idiot than I was before, some guy that I was living with said, hey, man, you know, what will really make you mellow during the debate and get rid of all your nerves and you'll just chill, you know. And he pulled out a reefer marijuana cigarette. He says, just have some tokes of this, man, and it'll be a breeze. Okay, I don't know what was in that joint besides regular marijuana. But whatever the grade of weed it was knock you on your you-know-what weed. So I do a number of heavy tokes on this marijuana cigarette. And I'm not an advocate of marijuana, by the way. I was desperate. I was trying to calm down my nerves. So I go into the classroom and I realize that I'm high as a kite, but I'm maintaining the facade of being totally rational and calm. The only problem is this marijuana is starting to bring on like slight paranoia, slight distortion in my thoughts. And it's interrupting the marijuana that I smoked was interrupting my God-given cognitive ability to remember, use logic, argue, use reason, and to defeat my opponents through a logical, linear, rational argument. The marijuana was interfering with that. To be blunt, the marijuana was crippling my debating ability. I didn't know that could happen because the guy told me it would make me mellow. No, it didn't make me mellow. It handicapped me. So I'm feeling all this as I'm walking to the class, and secretly, I'm petrified. I can feel my heart pounding like crazy. Because when your heart pounds like crazy, that's adrenaline, and adrenaline can become like a vicious cycle. So there I am, high on some very potent weed, and I'm trying to deliver this airtight lecture to defeat the reality of the Bible and Jesus Christ. And all I know, I didn't make a fool out of myself, but I wasn't hitting any home runs. I wasn't tying together any of my logical arguments. And in my own opinion, I would rate my performance, my debating performance, as like C-. It was like it was there, but it didn't come together. It flatlined. And I believe God allowed it because I used my God-given natural gifts and talents to defeat these two sweet Christian girls at the University of Missouri. And look, I wasn't born any smarter than they were. I was just in an environment where those gifts could be developed. And the Lord allowed me, I believe on purpose, the Lord set it up so I would be humbled before all the other classes of debate. I believe the Lord set it up that I would be humbled, that I would be deliberately humbled in front of these girls, in front of the professor, because I was so cocky the first time. And so it's like the Lord said, okay, now I'm going to remove my hand of protection off you. Because I think I went over the line when I used my verbal skills to attack two of his children who were preaching the gospel. So I believe God punished me, and I was humiliated and disgraced in that debate class because I didn't win. You know what I'm saying? And yet, that's okay. God still loved me, and it was necessary for me to receive that discipline from the Lord, and it was necessary for me to receive that chastisement from the Lord, and it was necessary for me to be humbled before the Lord. Because it was only then, after the Lord began to continue to break my proud spirit and to break my rebellious nature, the Lord allowed things in my life to come up that would break my pride and break my rebellious nature so that I would be forced to humble myself and come to Him and to cry out to Him alone, Jesus Christ, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, to cry out to Him alone to be my Lord and Savior, my Deliverer and Rescuer. So I know we went a long way around the mountain, but you see, if you gave your life to Christ and then you copped out on the deal, God's going to keep pursuing you. He's going to bring you back. There are people listening to me now, right now, all over the world. Say, how do you know that? I read the communications I get from all over the world on our various social media. You need to connect to that. Go to paulmcguire.us. Follow the YouTube. Follow the Vimeo. Follow the Roku. Follow the Facebook pages, multiple. Follow the Twitter. Follow all the different platforms for podcasting. Follow the video prophecies. Follow the daily radio show, paulmcguire.us. Read the books, the free articles. We have such a powerful amount of effective communication for you. But the Lord allowed me to be humbled so that I would cry out to Him for His wisdom, His deliverance, and that the Lord would now begin to force me to be painted into certain corners in life where I couldn't use my intelligence, my cleverness, my resources to triumph or escape. The Lord put me in positions where I would be desperate in my need for His help. And it was only when I was brought to a place of desperation in need for His help that caused me to cry out to God with purity of heart and ask God in desperation to supernaturally intervene in my life, supernaturally deliver, supernaturally rescue me, and supernaturally make me born again and transform my life. In other words, as is often the case when we're proud and rebellious, as is often the case, the Lord will often have to allow us to be broken, humbled, and chastised so that from our humility and chastisement, we'll truly cry out to Him and really mean it. And that happened, and that began the slow change in my life. You see, God knows how to discipline His own. And this is a word of the Lord to you from me right now. Wherever you're listening to the Paul McGuire Report on planet Earth, I feel that the Lord has put this in my spirit strongly to share to you listening now. Okay? And what the Lord is showing me is there's a large number of people, you know who you are, that you're listening to the Paul McGuire Report now, yet you've got a wall up, you're preoccupied, you're not fully listening, you're hearing it, but you're not really opening the door of your heart to the message, and you're not really sensitized to the Lord calling you out by name right at this very moment. Because right now, at this very moment, the Lord Jesus Christ is calling you out by your individual specific name. Jesus is calling on you, your name, and you right now in the name of Jesus. He's calling you to come out from the midst of them, and Jesus Christ is calling you to return and join with Him, be in fellowship with Him, and reconnect.